Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Pigment on a Surface, and it's about, well, art, making it, teaching it, being in the world, whatever. And our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about placing pigment on a surface, I guess, right? A little bit?
Arguably.
Arguably, right? Well, we'll see. Mr. Gene Marsh, thank you for coming. Say something for yourself. Introduce yourself to the kids at home, listening in their earbuds, eagerly looking for direction.
Hi, I'm Gene Marsh. I am a printmaker and a teacher at the Community College of Allegheny County. I'm one of the, I don't want to say resident artist isn't the right term, but I guess tenant artists at Millvale Studios. Which is currently dealing with a situation, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Yes, we will.
And yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So let's get right to it. And I want to start with, well, let's start with a stupid drunk uncle question.
Perfect.
Yes, which is the Clement. So pigment on a surface references something the art critic Clement Greenberg once said about modern art. And that, you know, for him saying after we got photographs and stuff, well, after the photograph, he said painting no longer has to be representational. It doesn't have to look like the thing. It is literally just pigment on a surface. He said sculpture is just making forms with materials. And the artist is free to then explore the possibilities of pigment on a surface in all of its wonderful ways. Because, of course, the stupid drunk uncle, why, you know, what is that art? Or, I like stuff that I can know what it is, right? And thinking about how art. Thinking about art and the way that it, you know, I think people have this one expectation of what art is. You know, bowls of fruit and
people like things that look like other things.
Yes.
And, you know, especially for me, who, you know, I teach this and I work with predominantly what we'd call non-traditional art students. Since I'm at the community college, I'm not necessarily working with a room full of dedicated art majors.
Yes.
Ever.
Yes.
So that's usually my starting point whenever I'm teaching anything, regardless if it's, you know, an intro art appreciation, through an art history or, you know, even one of my studios, is the idea that it doesn't have to be and doesn't necessarily, it shouldn't be just a thing that looks like a thing. You know, and, you know, to go back to the quote, photography plays a lot of that, I think. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I especially like to focus a lot on photography in teaching my art appreciation classes, which are usually gen ed students. Mm-hmm. Who don't have the background, and they're not going to be continuing on past that course.
Yeah.
Because it's accessible to them. Everybody, it's 2017, and we can all take our phone out of our pocket and take a photo of something.
Yeah. And that way, I mean, we're all photographers. Well, that's a weird thing, the cult of the amateur. But, I mean, in a way, we all have we can make.
We have the outlet.
It's the outlet, and it's accessible and immediate.
You know, the outlet's there, and the accessibility's there. And to bring this all around.
Sure.
What we were getting at originally, what separates, you know, the people that can just take out their phone and, you know, there's a difference, between taking a picture and composing a photograph.
Absolutely.
People that look at, you know, they'll look at like a Mark Rothko painting. Where it's just it's an orange rectangle and a blue rectangle.
Yes.
And it's like, yes, anybody can make those shapes, but do you have the intent behind them?
Mm-hmm.
What is the thought process? And I think, you know, really driving home that idea of, you know, art being you know, pigment on a surface or, mm-hmm. you know, a material molded into a form, is that I think, you know, genuinely believe anybody can do that stuff. But what really sets it apart is that idea of why are you doing it?
Yeah.
I think the why of something is always way more important than, you know, the how of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And because that is the, well, my kid could draw that, you know, kind of the, you know.
I shut that conversation down every time. It comes up every time.
Yeah.
Which,
you know, and I think, you know, in thinking about, because it's one of the things, like, I'll teach on occasion in my comp classes, Mark Rothko's Ret. It doesn't look really good on an LED projector.
It never does.
It's red.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, what? And I said, you know, if you see it in real life, it mixed in there. And think, actually, that is something with an incredible amount of skill. Every shade of red seems to be in red. Somehow, it's there. And it is just meant to make you celebrate the color red. This is the experience of red.
Yeah.
In its purest, unfettered, in your face, form possible.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like that intentionality is incredible.
I do something similar. I use Yves Klein in his blue canvases.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, you get these huge, just solid blue canvases, no variation in them. They're, you know, just these flat surfaces of color.
Yeah.
And then, and this is another reason, this is why I love, you know, working with the students that I do. I'll throw out, I'm like, you know, one of these just sold for like $1.6 million. Why do you think that is? And that's how I jump into the
conversation.
That's how I get the conversation. So, you know, why would...
teachable moment.
Why would somebody value, you know, a single blue color on the canvas to that degree?
Yeah. I mean, and it's also, I mean, hey, you know, to borrow that line from Alice Walker, right? You know, not noticing the color purple, thus the book, right? Is thinking about how, and maybe it's also in our contemporary lives, is this role of art, you know, is this thing that somehow demands attention to something? Because I think, you know, there's this great book, it's really dated now, because it talks about, it's called The Tyranny of the Moment by Thomas Hyland Erickson. And there's this moment where, you know, he freaks out about, or is kind of freaking out about, oh my God, AOL and Instant Messenger, like, and talking about how dial-up AOL with Instant Messenger accelerates life beyond a comfortable speed for him. You know what I mean? But you look at the whole experience of modernity for people has been life accelerated to an uncomfortable speed for most folks who knew something else.
Oh, absolutely.
And how that those kind of artistic representations, like, wait, stop, pay attention to this. Which is also, is that also, like, for you part of that conversation about intentionality?
Oh, yeah. That's... And this is one, I stole this straight out of the textbook I use. And I won't name it because it's a horrible textbook. one of the joys of adjunct life is having no say in that. But it does make a good point about learning to see something versus just looking at something passively.
Yeah.
I can very passively, look at the shelf of books that's in the room here with us, and I recognize it as a shelf of books.
Yeah.
But if I take time to stop and allow myself to, input and absorb and process all of the individual pieces of information on there, I get a much better understanding of, what's in front of me.
Yeah, and you think, I guess each one of these titles has a context and intentionality, and there's a half-assed attempt to kind of group them so that I can find stuff. If you put too much thought into it, you might go mad because I didn't put too much thought into it. But, the stuff is, History of Racism and the Henry Louis Gates Jr. Reader is together, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's a thing. I Don't See Color, a new book about white privilege from Penn State University Press is over there. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the point of, like, getting into, you know... And so part of the tension of that book I was mentioning by Thomas Hyland Erickson, The Tyranny of the Moment, which is totally out of date and out of print and has cost, like, ridiculous on Amazon last time I looked to get one. but I think the Carnegie Library has it, if they haven't purged it, is that the idea maybe in the information age... The survival technique is not about finding information, but blocking out all the excess information, which then, I mean, puts art in this weird place.
Yeah.
Because it is like, hey, pay attention to this, when maybe sometimes our spontaneous response is, you know, a mutual friend of ours just texted about the progressive liberal wrestling character. He's like, have you heard about that? And I was like, I read headlines about it. I scrolled past headlines about it. It's like, that's a lot of my, that sort of viral news. It's just like, well, I've scrolled past headlines about it.
Yeah.
And art is this thing that sort of like subverts that.
I was kind of thinking about that on the way over here. I was thinking about, you know, how much I saw just headline, just scrolling through my Facebook wall of majority of Republicans.
Hate college now. Yeah.
You know, like, do I need to read it?
The headline is the story.
Yeah.
Or if it's the story is written well, the headline's written well.
More to the story than that, but...
well, you know, I'm actually... Funny, the bookmark that I was scrambling to find when you rang my doorbell was... I was reading a book called Teaching Composition in the Age of Austerity. And yes, there is a long 40-year story of how we got to that point. But that's another podcast. So there is more to that, but there is this way that, you know, and maybe, you know, to bring these two threads together is thinking about how the worth of the art and humanities and art, let's talk about art, especially is it also to help people figure out their own experience, put some sort of meaning to it, whether it's enforcing an idea or making people think differently. And in that way, in these times we live in, art's never been more needed. But also, weirdly, we live in this era where art is never more sort of weirdly devalued for most people. And even their sort of access to it is sort of cut off. Because it is this thing, I mean, if you know anything about modern art and modern painting, the other one is, of course, Jackson Pollock, right? You know, if you know where he's coming from, the context and the moment of that is, or, I don't know, this guy just threw some paint at the thing.
Yeah, and it's kind of, there's always that struggle against that dismissiveness.
Yeah.
Of, especially like post-World War II American art, you get... You know, your abstract expressionist and, you know, Pollock, de Kooning, those guys. And Pollock is another one. He's a very teachable artist for helping people overcome that dismissiveness. Because you can look at his paintings, you can take them at face value if you want to. It's like you're saying, it can be, oh, he just took some paint cans and threw them at a canvas, but then you realize that's not even how he did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you take, you know, if you really take the time to learn what that painting is, you have this guy with these big, raw, unstretched canvases on the floor of his studio, and he's punching holes in paint cans with, you know, a screwdriver and walking across the surface of the canvas, and they're called action paintings because he's recording his action as he walks across the room.
Yeah.
I mean, you get close to them and you'll see like little bits of garbage and dirt and dust and crap in there that like just rolled off the floor with them.
Yeah, which is, thinking about what a great statement for action painting. What a great statement for now our times when we think about how, you know, there was a thread on my Facebook this morning about, you know, the smartphone, and like we are constantly allowing ourselves to be tracked. Like, you know, are we action paintings now? Or are we action, you know, data now, I guess?
That's what I think, you know, I'm probably going to give away you know, my best spur of the moment idea in a while for free.
Okay.
For the podcast, but it'd be great if there was just some app that just traced your movement as a painting, like through the day.
Yeah, well, you know, I think some people have done
there's something similar to that.
Well, you know, so I have, well, you think about this. Let's think about this here. I think someone has done something like this, but I, you know, I do map my walk. I did my walk this morning, which makes me wonder if, you know, a urbanite, middle-aged man, middle-aged somebody, urbanite, effete, cosmopolitan, goes for a walk and there's not an app to record it as exercise. Does it really happen? Right? I mean, that's the question. Because the Fitbit, right, is like, no.
Because then it brings up this whole other question. Do we need other people to know it happened?
Why, do we need...
I mean, we've hit a point where it's like we need this... I don't know if it's validation or what, where we constantly need people to know that we did something.
Yes. Which is, I mean, is also an weirdly artistic impulse, right? I mean, you have to have some sort of, I don't want to call it hubris or some, you know, my big art thing goes back to those cave paintings in France, right?
Yeah.
Just the handprints. It's like, yeah. I was here, I am somebody on that wall for 30,000 years.
Now they can trace, you know, they've been tracing the individual artists now through the, you know, just through the DNA that they left on those walls. And they're finding bodies of work by... You know, obviously we don't have identities for these people, but...
They are people. And there's something with us. But, you know, when I do map my walk, there is a shape. I get a red line where I was. Now, granted, I actually do the same path. I just go to a certain point and then come back. But you could do a screenshot of that and, like, make shapes.
Yeah.
You know, in urban space. And either isolate, take those shapes. I wonder if you take that red line and put it on a different background or something.
Oh, yeah.
You could do it. It's going to be done. You could do this. This could happen.
I think it could work.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, because I was thinking about, too, I mean, this whole space and somebody, I remember reading in the 90s an interview with one of the guys in Einstitz and the Neubauten. And he was saying how he, actually it was a really fascinating interview. Like he had this setup in his house where everything that was stationary was white and everything that moved was black. And he says, imagine how hard it is to find a black toothbrush.
Yeah.
Right? But then he says, you know, and he's like, I do all these things, and I guess he also does do visual art, and he does, you know, the music thing. And he's like, I wanted something completely meaningless. And so he took a Polaroid of every hotel bathroom of every hotel room he ever stayed in. And so he just has this collection of Polaroids of every hotel room he's ever taken. He goes to the bathroom, shoots a Polaroid, and... I wonder if he still does Polaroid. I wonder if A still doesn't B, you know. I know there's, like, people who now reversed engineered Polaroid.
Yeah, Polaroid is... It's making a comeback. It's been showing up back on the shelves.
Oh, yeah. I love my Polaroid cameras.
Thanks, hipsters, for that.
Yeah, you know, that's not a bad thing.
Thanks for giving back.
Thanks for giving back. Look,
helping film for C.
Perfect. See, I got a Polaroid of me and John Waters at the Andy Warhol Museum.
Film photography.
Yeah.
God bless people not wanting to... I don't think art always is advancement. Sometimes we need to...
Slow things down
a little bit and look at what we have.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, even, you know, to get back, you know, kind of on track with the guy, you know, like what you were just saying, the shooting the Polaroids, it's... There's, like... I mean, there's a creative urge that everybody has.
Yeah.
Regardless of if you do this, you know, professionally or make it your life's work or not. And I think, at least, you know, this is what I kind of take pride in, what really has become my real focus of my teaching, is getting people to recognize where they're already doing it, and then...
Yeah. There's another way in. That's another way to bridge that gap.
Yeah, like, you're already doing it, now you just need to understand why you're doing it.
Yeah!
And, you know, along the way, we'll teach you some new ways to get it. There. Yeah.
And to get better at what you're doing, yeah. I guess. And Yeah, so speaking of doing it, then, can we talk about your own art and your own process?
Yeah.
Because that's the other, maybe that's another way to sort of demystify this stuff, is talking about how does one get from point A to point B, or how, like, that transition from, well, I guess there's two ways. This one, we can talk sort of historically, like, what, you know, what kind of things did you make, what kind of things are you making now, or in a very immediate sense, the journey between initial idea to finished product. Your choice.
I don't care. I think it's hard to separate one from the other completely. Well. I mean, ultimately, how I ended up here.
Okay.
And, you know, doing what I do, is that I'm not good at anything else. and I always say that in jest. You know, I always like the joke. You know, it's a very easy sell to my parents to tell them I'm going to art school. I'm like, what the hell else can I do?
Yeah.
It started early. You know, a lot of people in my family come from artistic backgrounds.
Mm.
So it's not something that I was totally sheltered away from, you know, growing up. But, you know, from an early age, I just, you know, I picked up on the talent early on. And, you know, I'm not saying that to, like, brag about my skills.
But I mean, that's total Howard Gardner, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's
some people have a thing.
Some people just have it.
And then you just keep doing thing, and then you get really good at it. You develop that part of the brain.
And you're always developing it. You know, I look at stuff I did 2 years ago, and I hate it. Like, I'm like, you know, what was I thinking? So that really... I've lost my body of work twice now in my life.
Oh, no.
And this last time kind of was bad, but the first time I wasn't complaining too much because it was my undergrad work. But you look back at that stuff and you're like, oh, Lord, what the fuck was I doing? But, yeah, I mean, I knew from when I was a kid, like, this is what I was going to end up doing. I can't picture myself doing anything else, honestly. You know, teaching it is now, like, the next step of that.
Yeah.
It's, like, the only other thing that really gives me that same level of satisfaction or accomplishment, besides making the work, is just teaching other people how to do it. So that's really how I kind of came along with it. I was, you know, I was lucky enough to have, you know, have the right support group, I guess, to make that happen.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to be attending public school when they still funded their art programs.
Yeah, remember that? Remember those glorious days?
That was great,
days?
Wasn't it?
Getting pre-austerity education.
Getting to be a teenager and actually exhibiting your work in public.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's still out there, not as much as it should be, though.
Yeah, definitely.
But, then, you know, I took the pretty traditional path from there. Got my bachelor's, went on, got my MFA. Came out at just the right time for all the jobs to disappear.
So that's the thing about, right, our generation, our cohort, right? Generational cohort, right? Okay, so there was still a little bit of old world art in school. Metal detectors? Are you pre-metal detectors?
No, they happened during my time.
Oh, see, I'm a little older than you. I nicely missed the metal. Yeah. I'm pre-Columbine schooling. So you had that, but then all the academic jobs went away.
But, you know, what can you do?
Well, what you can do is organize and form a union,
which I do know a little bit about.
Yes, what you did, yes, right, is fight for your right to have education.
Yeah, you know, I came out of grad school and I had a terrible service industry job for a while, and then I finally, you know, found some adjunct work.
Mm-hmm.
Which, believe it or not, there's not a whole lot of demand for part-time art history teachers.
Yeah.
Which, even art history, I ended up teaching that almost by accident. It was more of necessity than... I don't think I'd be teaching that course at a university, for example. But it's intro level.
Yeah.
I think any intro level class we should all be able to teach anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty, you know, uncomfortable there. Actually, it ended up being one of my favorite classes. But, so, I ended up, you know, I got into teaching, started working, you know, with foundations courses, theory classes, intro design stuff, you know, art appreciation, intro art history. the last few years I've been finally teaching in my specific field, which is printmaking.
Mm.
And that has been amazing. And one of the best experiences of my life is getting to actually teach what I do. And there's a little bit of ego to it, knowing that there's this, outgoing group that are now doing things the way that I do them.
Yeah.
Which are, there's that lineage there. That
yeah,
if they're doing
absolutely.
Things the way I did them, then they're also doing the way things, the people that taught me how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can't beat, you can't beat having those years of experience to draw on and to learn from. And I think, the most successful students are the ones that do that.
Absolutely.
Take advantage of that. It's something I tried to do. I always like to say I was, my grades don't reflect it, but I was a pretty terrible student.
Yeah, me too. I'm with you on that. Which I think probably makes you a good professor.
It does. I'm actually glad that I was not like some, grad school all-star.
Yeah.
Or like wonder kid, because I'd be terrible at my job.
They usually are. I didn't say that, but I just did.
Yeah.
And we won't edit that out, but it's the truth.
Yeah. Just don't do the stupid stuff I did.
Well, maybe a little.
Yeah.
A little bit.
If it's the fun, stupid stuff, go ahead.
Yeah. But, no, I get you there. And I think, so can we talk about printmaking? And
yes. Let's
talk about printmaking. All right.
What do you want to know?
How? What? Why?
How? I'm very process-oriented in how I approach everything.
Okay.
And I really like to work with my hands. And I think part of it too is I don't necessarily need that immediate response of like a brush on canvas. Because printmaking is if you're doing a relief print or a litho or even silkscreen, which is one of your faster processes, or an etching, you're putting hours and days and sometimes weeks into this before you ever see one. Before you ever get to that point of pigment on a surface, you might already be a month into this, into this project.
Wow.
And so there's I get a real sense of accomplishment when I actually finish an edition. Or I should say I shouldn't say actually, it makes it sound like I never finish anything.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, I've got to finish those two blocks that I've had sitting in a drawer for a year.
Oh, jeez.
They're carved. I just have to finish. They're proofed. I just have to run the additions on them.
Mm.
No hurry.
Yeah. They're there. That's always there. Been there. Yeah. Which, I didn't think about it, because my art history teacher at St. Francis, Chuck Olson. Hi, Chuck. Sometimes he listens. He talked about how... I remember you going in this thing about watercolor and how watercolor you have to think in reverse because you can't make it lighter, right? Well, paint, you can. And I'm thinking about that. So your thought process, and I guess, as opposed to other mediums then, do you have an idea in your head like it's going to look like this when it's done? And does it look exactly like that when it is done?
At this point, yeah, finally.
Yay! Awesome.
I've only been doing this since I was a teenager, but...
Well, isn't that another barrier to art, right? We want instant gratification,
You have to learn to just get over your own bullshit a little bit.
Okay.
And just accept that things are going to not be good.
Ooh.
One thing I always... hopefully it helps students keep from getting discouraged. I tell them, you're going to make... For every, one good edition you do, you might do, three or four or five bad ones.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just part of the process. That's how you learn how to do it. You were learning how to do it. I know how to do it. It comes a lot, like I said, I've been printmaking since I was a teenager. And, 35 when I finally feel comfortable with it.
I'm with you. I started writing poetry when I was 16. I think being earnest, I'm going to be a poet. And I think at about 36, I finally pushed out a poem that was like, oh, that one's good.
Yeah.
That one turned out the way I wanted it to. And then I completely rewrote the second verse. But still, it was a threshold moment.
But you felt good about it.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest barrier you have to get there, is just feeling good about what you're doing, feeling confident about what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so, talking about, does, are things coming out the way I expect mm-hmm. them to, and mm-hmm. do I know going in? At this point, I do.
Yeah.
And that came from years of not knowing any of that, yeah. and just, you know, develop. It's a skill and it's a craft like anything else, and it takes time and it takes work, and it takes thought. You know, I mean, you can't passively, you know, approach this stuff. You have to really think. You know, most of my sketchbooks are just text. They're just notes.
Oh, wow.
That I've taken on just what I'm doing. You know, every time I touch the pressure gauge on the press, it's going to change how that comes out. Oh, wow. So, you know, I keep track of everything. You know, I keep track of things. You know, right now, recently, I've been hand printing. And that's mostly been, I've been doing smaller pieces that are kind of impractical to just run through a large etching press.
Yeah.
So just hand rubbing with a wooden spoon and a Baron. Actually, is a lot quicker than having to set up ink and then set up the press every time. You know, for a little 4x6 block. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, at this point, you know, I have my idea and I have my process. And, you know, like I was saying before, it's, you know, I have my process now.
Yeah.
And it was informed by people that I've worked with in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, either, you know, people who were my teachers or, you know, my peers in the studio. Some of it just came from, you know, my own necessity, just figuring out a way, you know, figuring out what works for me.
Yeah.
So at this point, you know, I know when I start, you know, when I start the project, I know, I'd say 99.9% what it's going to be like when it comes out. And then that's, you know, when you get to that comfort level, that's when you try to knock yourself back out of it.
Mm.
And start adding, you know, for a while, you know, for a couple of years, you know, the challenge for me was like, I wanted to do really good black and white relief prints. You know, something that came out of, you know, just my own education was this push towards, you know, multi-layer, multi-color printing. And it's important. I teach it.
Yeah.
That's how you get good at it.
Yeah.
And that's how you learn the skill of layering those things. But finally, you get to that point where you're out of school for a while and you realize, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of break, and I don't want to say, it's not that you're, like, breaking some programming or something, but you get into a habit.
You do, yeah, absolutely.
And you realize you don't have to stick to that anymore. And so I was like, I'm going to make the best, you know, black and white block prints that I can. So I was doing that for a while, and now I'm back into layering and building up images. They're still completely achromatic, and I think it's just an aesthetic choice for me right mm-hmm. now. Also, a little inside baseball, it's a budgetary.
Well, I'm sure it is, yeah.
It's a lot easier to buy a can of black and a can of white than to... And at this point, now that my studio burned down, I'm glad I didn't invest a lot of money in it.
But, oh, dear.
But yeah, just building up... you know, if you look back, you know, if you go on my Facebook page and you look back to the last work in progress I posted before everything went to the point of disaster, that was a four-color four-color relief print. And even then, you know, I'm kind of feeling like I'm at the point where I want to push past that a little bit.
Yeah.
To something, you know, more challenging. It's, you know, I've got my process down and I never want to feel like I'm, you know, even though I'm teaching it and I'm doing it professionally and actually selling some work for a change, which is always nice, I never want to feel like I'm not continuing to learn my craft.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, you know, kind of my most recent focus on that has been, you know, setting up the studio over in Millvale. You know, a lot of my, you know, projects for about 4 months were just building equipment.
Oh, wow.
And transforming a space into just what I needed it to be.
Wow.
To make my work. And then it all caught on fire.
Yeah, that is... I remember seeing that on the FaceTube. Yeah, that was intense.
Yeah, I was at home. I just settled in for the evening. And I went on Facebook and saw a video of fire trucks outside.
Oh, wow.
So I ran over and... Luckily... The building is still there.
There's the building is still there. Nobody got hurt.
Nobody got hurt, which is the most important thing.
Yeah.
The only real losses most of us suffered was we lost some work, but mm-hmm. you know, equipment and life and limb were all safe. I take it as a point of pride that my wooden workbenches didn't immediately go up.
Oh, they see.
Which is nice. I have to go get them out of the garage over there. So they can, I guess the cleanup crews are already in there and underway. But, you know, a lot of my, you know, I was feeling very comfortable as a printmaker, but I didn't feel comfortable with where I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I was either working at home, which is very limiting.
Yeah.
Or I was working on campus where you never really get to go off the clock.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in there, and, you know, if I'm on campus, I know, I'm there, I'm Mr. Marsh, and I'm there to help and answer questions, but sometimes you just need to...
Need a room of one's own.
Yeah, you need to focus on what you're doing, and you need to focus on your work.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got lucky, you know, one of my colleagues there, Patrick Lee, he hooked me up with the Millvale Studios group. Mm-hmm. There were a few people that had already been in the space working, and, you know, I think, you know, the group and I kind of fit like a glove, which is always important. And I think that's one of the things that really held me back before was I never really felt like I was in the right environment.
Yeah.
And not, you know, I don't want to say that I wasn't with the right people because a lot of them were people that were my friends for years.
Yeah.
That I know very well, but, you know, any number of factors just wasn't making it the right, you know, situation to be, you know, conducive to what I needed to do. And, you know, kind of a situation like that over in Millvale where I got to be just in charge of my space. You know, the first thing I did after we had our, you know, opening back in, I guess it was late March.
Oh, wow.
I ripped up the floor in my space. It's an old furniture building. My workspace had, you know, this old shag carpet from, you know, who knows how long it had been in there.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, this is horrible. And I took it out and I painted my floor and built some workbenches and put up some drying racks. And I make it sound like it was quick. It took about 4 months to get to that point. But
yeah. But, I mean, that's too. I mean, infrastructure and support are important.
Yeah.
You know, which is, again, you know, we're at this moment where, you know, is the NEH going to be completely, or the NEA, and the NEA and the NEH completely eliminated from the federal budget.
Yeah.
And to think about how, I don't know, we'll lose a generation or decades of American culture if we do that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's definitely a time to become more self-reliant.
Yeah.
In preserving what we do and preserving the importance of what we do.
Yeah.
And making sure it, you know, stays relevant.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, I'd posted something on my Facebook page probably about a month or so ago. But, you know, I had, like, just the very inkling of a kernel of an idea for a paper or some kind of study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's kind of what it tied into.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, we're only 7 months into this current situation.
Yeah.
But, you know, give it about, you know, maybe another year and see where we're at.
Yeah.
And see how that's affecting, you know, the role of, you know, the role of the arts in our culture. What, you know, what are we doing to respond to, you know, this, what's becoming an increasingly hostile environment.
Yeah.
For people that are, you know, creatives are typically historically seen as dissidents.
Yeah.
Let's see how we're responding to that.
Dissidents, leftists, pinkos, you know, whatever,
yeah,
right?
Degenerates. I mean, you go back to
degenerates,
like Hitler's degenerate art, you know, the fascist degenerate art.
Yeah, which they then sold for tons of money.
Yeah.
But you know,
the artists were being, you know, you had someone like Kirshner who killed himself in response to that show.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, and it's this weird thing because there was a great, there's this great series on Netflix now about, I know I just said I hated Netflix on the last podcast, but if you use it responsibly, and there's a series, and I forget what it's called, about like the history of stolen art, and they talked about those shows that were actually much more popular than the nationalist, traditionalist shows, right? I mean, because after all, Hitler didn't get into art school because he sucked and was not, you know, that stage you're talking about, that comfort, that discomfort stage, you know, my art history teacher called it the hell stage. You know, as you just go through this period where nothing works.
Not the worst name. I went through a very long one of those.
Yeah.
And it was, I don't even call it discomfort stage. It was like, I was just at a stop. I was like, I just had no answers. I would try something and it just, nothing worked. And nothing worked. Nothing. And that's when you start making changes. Change your environment. I started going to more, you know, life model sessions, drawing sessions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, start going back through... past movements that I hadn't, you know, maybe really given enough time to in the, you know, in my own studies and seeing how that relates to my work.
Yeah.
Like right now, I'm especially, you know, when as a student, I was always being told my work was very expressionistic, mm-hmm. and at the time, I think that was a fair assessment. You know, moving forward, you know, coming out of school and then working up and getting to the point where I can finally consider myself a professional, you know, I tried way too long to stay in that kind of pigeonhole that I'd been put in, and I was miserable and I was just making bad work. And you go back and so I'm like, it works and there's still elements there in what I do, but... You know, then, you know, I start looking at, you know, artists like Courbet and the, you know, realist movement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, that, you know, that, you know, at least right now is speaking a whole lot more to me than, you know, these anguished, pained, you know, nightmare portraits that I was doing, you know, in the early 2000s.
Yeah. So that was a time for anguished nightmares. Yeah. But
it was. And I think we're coming around.
Coming around, yeah.
But no, even that, like, you know, thinking about, you know, how are we responding to, you know, the current environment? I think we are going to see a lot of that.
Yeah.
From a lot of people, and it's going to be justified. I don't think that's going to be how I approach it anymore. Yeah. You know, I always describe my own work as just portraits of sad people eating. And what's funny is I've never actually done a portrait of anyone eating until the most recent one I started. I finally was like, I should actually do one where somebody's eating something. And so it's a self-portrait of me. I'm eating this, you know, I've got this like fork full of spaghetti, shoving it into my mouth. And that's where like the realism aspect of it comes in, is just capturing your subject, no matter who or what it is, just with that degree of honesty and vulnerability to it. You know, I could try to do all the, you know, biting satire in my work.
Yeah.
That I want, but I think that takes a degree of subtlety that I don't possess, and that I don't necessarily want to possess.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's going to be a lot more honest. And this is another, you know, to take it back to teaching, this is something I always, at least have one student that struggles with this every semester, is just making sure the work you're doing is honest.
Yeah.
You know, I had a student maybe about a year ago. They kind of run together eventually, time-wise.
They do. They really do.
And all he cared about was selling work. And, like, selling his stuff. And the talent was there. But then I'd ask him, like, well, where did you get these images from? Because I know you didn't design these.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, you know, they're vector files I found online. I'm like... Yeah, it was like, I could buy that on a t-shirt at Spencer's right now if I was so inclined. Like, I mean, if you want to sell work, make something that's honest, make something that's representative of you, and people will respond to that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't necessarily think, you know, selling work is the mark of success. I think everybody's, you know, at least for me anyway, everybody's got, you know, their own definition of that, obviously. You know, I'm sure there's plenty of people that are making and selling their work as a way to survive and pay the bills, I would argue that with me, and they're totally right.
Yeah. No, they're not wrong, but again, yeah.
Yeah, you just have to, you have to be honest with what you're doing, and you have to allow, you have to allow yourself to be present in the work. And, you know, to go back, let's take this all the way back to our, you know, Greenberg quote.
Yes, let's close the loop.
Somewhere, I knew I was going to come back to that.
Yeah.
You know, what separates, you know, what separates contemporary art, especially, or any artwork really, from just being pigments on a surface, is that honesty of the person making it.
Yeah.
They're, you know, anybody can, you know, anybody can draw a stick figure, anybody can make a red square on a white canvas, but having that intent behind it and having that be, you know, this pure, pure expression of the person making that mark, that's what sets it apart.
Yeah.
That's what makes it more than just, you know, again, that pigment on a surface. It's why, you know, why I think, you know, work like that's always going to be infinitely more interesting than just making, you know, I always call it a thing that looks like another thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, still life painting is great, but why are you doing a still life, you know?
Yeah, what are you getting? Yeah.
You know, what are you getting from it creatively? Because if you're getting something from it, other people are going to get something from it.
Which is this weird sort of counterintuitive. I mean, it's that winter driving, right? Tip, right? You steer into the skid.
Yeah.
Which you think about, like, the that weird way that the more... And this is something that my students struggle with writing, is the more personal something becomes, the weirdly more universal.
Yeah.
It gets, or at least the very... Or at least the more personal it gets, even if it doesn't go totally universal, it's... it finds an audience, or an audience finds it because of that, in this really weird counterintuitive way. It's like, you know, the way to appeal to people is maybe to try not to appeal to people so much.
Yeah, art is a very, it's a very self-centered enterprise to a degree. Just to go back to that idea of honesty, like, somebody can, and this is another thing that I always see students struggling with, they just want to go online and find a reference.
Mm-hmm.
And I make it, I'm like, no, that sucks, don't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, if you don't care enough to create it, nobody's going to care enough to want to look at it.
Yeah, why would they care? You know?
Yeah, like, you can Google that. You know, probably the title, because you probably just took the title right from the file name.
Yeah.
And see the original. But if you put yourself into that work, even if you're appropriating it, you know, and that, there's a lot of validity to appropriating imagery.
Yeah.
But you still have to put yourself into it. You have to create your own context for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what people respond to. You know, they're looking for... You know, I think the consumers of, and I hate the word consumer because it makes it sound like we're just creating a product and putting it on a shelf.
Target and Applebee's, yeah.
Yeah, well, but like a...
Patron? No, I see that.
Not even...
That's so weird, too.
Like the...
Audience?
Audience, viewer.
Viewer,
something like
yeah,
that.
Subject.
The people that are absorbing.
Yeah.
Or intended
to. The experiencers.
Yes, the experiencers is a good one. I'm going to start using that from now on. It's way better than what I usually stumble over in class.
Yeah.
But you have your experiencers, and you have those that are creating the experience. And,
yeah.
You know, nobody goes into a museum because they want to be bored. Nobody goes into a gallery because they want to be bored and disinterested.
Yeah.
You know, they go because they want to see something that they're not going to see anywhere else, and to experience something that they haven't experienced before.
Yeah.
And usually, you know, if you go into a show and you think it sucks, it's probably because you've seen that.
Yeah.
How many hundreds and thousands of times in your life somewhere else?
Yeah, or maybe it just doesn't celebrate any aspect of the human experience or any human's experience.
Yeah, like,
you know,
if it's not personal to you, it's not going to be, you know. I hate the word relatable, but relatable to anyone else.
Or human, or I mean, I guess, you know, there is that just idea of contact, which again, maybe is if we're thinking about art in this contemporary context where it's never been more needed, but never been less valued.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, think about how, to go back to like what we were saying about, you know, always having to post what you're doing at every moment. We're increasingly sheltered. Like, we want everybody to know what we're doing, but we're keeping them at arm's length.
Yeah, which exactly.
Isn't that such the... That's, like, the perfect parallel to...
Yeah, absolutely. There is. I mean, I remember, you know, I went through a stage. I think for me, as a writer of poetry, one of the things that happened before I was 36 is, you know, I was like, I got Facebook. And I think I went through a period where I realized, finally... And I've really scaled back. You know, it's like now I just share links and images. But sometimes the things that I would put thought into writing, I realized at some point, I was like, oh, shit. Those are the things that used to be poems and used to become poems.
Yeah.
You know? And weirdly now, thank you, Mark Zuckerberg, Lord Zuckerberg, for the On This Day feature. But now I can go back and aha, and I've actually written stuff now that I was like, oh, that status update, that's a note, actually.
Yeah.
And I can get back to that moment and that experience and try to write it out, you know. But yeah, it is this weird way that you get this like lesser form. You know, Instagram is a lesser form, maybe, than, you know, someone, yeah, actually taking time and intentionality to compose a photograph. You could just go, it's this. It's the cheap cut. It's the McDonald's cheeseburger.
Yeah.
It's not. You know? Yeah, but it's not, that's pretty good. You know, you can eat that. It's fun. You know?
It'll get you through the day.
Yeah.
It fulfills its purpose, but it's not.
If you only try to live on it, you die.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's the same kind of thing. Or my favorite is, I like since I haven't had McDonald's in a few years, the cheddar biscuit. You know, cheddar biscuits at Red Lobster, they're pretty good.
Yeah.
You can't live on them, but sometimes...
I mean, yeah. I wish I could live on them, but...
Yeah. Well, you could, but just for a very short time.
Yeah, it's going to end poorly.
Yeah.
You're going to be sad, alone, with your basket of cheddar biscuits and your food gone.
Watching Netflix.
What? All of this... Like, if you just added the cheddar biscuits, you're basically describing my life right now. But that's only because I'm not teaching second summer.
Yeah. you need rest, and you need to rebuild the studio. So there is a benefit coming up, is that right?
It's not technically a benefit. Millvale Studios was originally going to be a part of the Millvale Sculpture Festival on July 22nd. And we were going to be hosting a show in the space.
Mm.
Unfortunately, as we've alluded to a couple times during the
podcast the space here, had a bit of a fire.
Had a fire a few weeks ago, and has to be gutted.
Mm.
So we're raising some funds to help repay the artists, help make some obviously needed repairs. Mm-hmm. Thank God there was a tin drop ceiling in there that protected the roof.
Mm.
So last I heard, there wasn't any serious... Structural damage to the building.
That's really good.
What's nice, it's an old furniture store, so it's all concrete. It's all cement. So the structure was intact. But July 22nd is the Millvale Sculpture Festival. So I encourage everybody to go down. There's going to be some great work at Riverfront Park in Millvale.
Mm.
And that evening, from 6 to midnight, at Panza Gallery at 115 Sedgwick Street in Millvale. There's going to be an art and after party exhibition, and gathering and opening. And obviously you can, donate some funds there if you'd like, mm-hmm. to go towards the rebuilding effort at the studio. There's going to be live music and food, and obviously, I don't know if it's going to be the same show that would have been in our space, but there's going to be a show there. They also have an exhibition right now, Pittsburgh Society of Artists, which I wasn't able to make it to the opening last weekend, unfortunately, but I'm going to try to make it over maybe tomorrow. So you can contribute if you'd like to that way. Also, anybody that wants to make a donation to the rebuilding effort can send a check to the Millvale Community Development Corporation,
mm.
at 501 Lincoln Avenue, Millvale, PA, 15209.
Great.
I haven't memorized, but I haven't memorized this point.
And I'll put links to that, of course, on the podcast. And, of course, you have a personal artist Facebook
group, right? Yeah, I was right in the middle. I was starting my process of going totally legit, independent professional artist when all this happened. But if you go to facebook.com/gmarsh.art, that is my professional artist page.
Mm-hmm.
Right now it's sitting at about 5 updates.
I understand, yeah. 5 updates, but I'm sure you got, because it's Facebook, at least 10 alerts about constantly. Can get more, but yeah.
Constantly. yeah, my professional Facebook journey was, here's some of my prints, here's some of my drawings.
Mm.
Here's what I'm working on right now, and oh shit, my building just burned down.
Oy.
Which is always fun.
Which is always fun.
It's good to have adversity to overcome.
The hell stage. We're back to the hell stage.
Yeah, we're right back into the hell stage, making prints in the laundry room. It's okay.
And on that note, it's now time for the bottom 5. The bottom 5 is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Yes. Now, what have you gotten yourself into? Are you ready, Gene?
I am ready.
You are ready. All right. Bottom 5 question. Cool. Question 1. Everybody gets this question the first time. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
Oh, that's fantastic. And the first thing that sprung to mind was botulism.
Botulism, you know?
I think there's some good revenge possibility there.
There's good revenge possibility. There is
also... I feel like I could use my botulism powers for good.
Well, Botox.
Yeah.
Botox and revenge.
I could make people have weird, shiny foreheads. Or... or...
or...
or... I could maybe get rid of some people that need to be gotten rid of, you know?
There you go. The avenging angel. Yeah. I like it. I like it a lot. Of course, some of those people are the same people.
I know. It's weird, right?
Yeah, I know. Botulism.
Like, maybe the Botox is my way in. That's how I get in the system.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I just need to... replicate.
These yes, replicate.
And horrible lives. What are they doing to make this go quicker?
Yes. There you go. I love it. All right. Question 2. It's just not a question. This is a prompt. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood.
Oh, that's a good one.
So I mean by that is not necessarily like, oh, we went to Disney World, but it rained and baked cookies. It rained and we baked cookies or something like that.
I'm going to have to really dig deep on this one.
Oh, boy.
Years of poorly ventilated studios have sometimes left my memory questionable.
Yeah, it's also, I think, a late 30s thing.
It is. Yeah. It's just...
it's weird.
I'm past the point where that excuse works anymore, and now I just have to admit, like, no, I'm just getting older.
Yeah.
And I'm getting closer and closer to just middle age and not remembering shit.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm already there. It sucks.
Oh, jeez, a happy but unremarkable childhood memory.
Yeah.
All right, this is the first thing that's springing to mind.
Okay.
And I only remember I was at my grandparents' house in Newcastle, and I was grounded. And I don't remember what I had done, but my dad snuck me out of the house and we went to see Teen Wolf 2.
Teen Wolf T-O-O.
Yes. With Jason Bateman.
That's fantastic. Teen Wolf 2.
I don't know why that specifically sprung to mind, but...
because of the T-O-O.
Yeah.
And it was forbidden T-O-O.
It was, I mean, of all things, that was my big jailbreak was... you know, I don't remember the circumstances that led to that movie being chosen, but wow. I have to believe I picked it.
Yeah. Teen Wolf 2. Love it. All right. Question 3. What is one pop culture text you wish more people knew about? Something from pop culture or something just maybe culturally, if we want to talk about art or whatever. That you wish just more people knew about or more people got into?
I think you know, I wish more people knew about, you know, going back to this idea of everybody has that creative impulse. And they don't necessarily have the outlet.
Yeah.
I wish they knew how many outlets there were.
Yeah.
To let that out. Just, you know, go on, you know, go on like the Facebook events page, like the suggested events, and you find stuff left and right. You know, just off the top of my head, I can think of probably three or four, you know, figure drawing sessions that anybody can go to of any skill level.
Wow.
That wants to get better at drawing. Things like, you know, just free workshops.
Yeah.
You know, last summer I went to a zine workshop at, you know, Most Wanted. There's stuff like that, you know, like the zine fair that's coming up. You know, I wish more people were aware of, you know, the outlets that already exist for them to take advantage of, you know, artistically.
That's great. And I guess then the communities there that...
Yeah.
We all need a little community these days, I think. Question three. Question three is a scenario. It's a sci-fi scenario. I got to paint the scenario, all right?
Perfect.
All right. So say society has collapsed, and whatever the new order is anti-book. They're against books. So imagine if we were living in a dystopian future, and the only way for individual books to survive would be those bound in human skin. Right? Basically, they're purging all the books, and unless somebody walks, you know, this volume under their, tucked under their shoulder, right into the tannery, it's gone from human history. Right? This is a scenario. If this were the case, would you then sort of volunteer to walk, march into the tannery, you know? And they're not total barbarians. It's not like they're going to skin you alive. I mean, they'll crush your head between two cinder blocks or something when this goes down.
Well, do they even have to at this point? I mean,
yeah,
just take, I'm not using my back skin. That's what shirts are for.
There you go. All right. It might get a little infected, though.
Nah.
Yeah, botulism will come for you that way.
Yeah.
Well, would you, and what book would you donate your skin for? And you also, I'm saying there's another, there's a caveat, too. You can't say the Bible, the Quran, or the complete works of Shakespeare. Somebody got those. Somebody got those.
And I wouldn't say those anyway.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Would I?
Would I? And would if so, I? What book?
I definitely would. It's tough to think. You know, what would I sacrifice my own, literally sacrifice, you know, my own skin
for?
For.
Or else future humanity does not have access to it.
I wish I read more. This is why I'm an artist, Matt.
Well, you know, it could be... Well, here we go. Here we go.
This is a catalog. Yeah, like a generic answer. Because I don't have a specific text in mind as much as I have a type of text. Again, not the one that I use on campus because it kind of sucks. But like a decent art history text.
A decent art history text.
Something that just comprehensively recorded, you know, the history of visual... You know, to go back to, you know, why, you know, needing to know why things are made. Just preserving some kind of text that tells people why things are made.
I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah. Knowing and understanding our visual tradition, I mean, that predates written language.
And that's, yeah, shit.
And if we're talking about getting rid of, you know, if we're talking about this, you know, kind of purging of written language... you know, making sure that we understand the alternative.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
What led to that point? Because I mean, even you know, go back to you, know, you go back to the ancient Near East, where you know, we see cuneiform being used to you know translate ideas across cultures, and visual language. Is what led to those books being created in the first place, or you know, at least partially being possible.
Like it, that's a good one. That might be one of the best ones answers to that question so far. We're almost through question five. Question five, we're almost done here in the home stretch. If there is a hell, and you end up there, name one celebrity that you expect/hope to meet there.
One that I expect/hope to meet there. So many.
So many.
So many. Like, it, that's the problem, is, like, it's... I love this question because it's hell, obviously.
Yes.
So it's not going to be anybody that I like.
Yeah.
Like, there's nobody down there, like, that I'm going to... Like, any, like, I don't have a real intense hero worship for a lot of celebrities. But I know, like, I'm definitely not going to see Lemmy in hell. Because it's hell.
Yeah.
There's no way hell's... Like, there's no way it would be cool enough. In my own personal disastrous afterlife.
Yeah.
Get to hang out with my heroes.
Yeah.
I mean, like, somebody like that is who I would hope to see there.
Yes.
But I think who you hope to see and who you expect to see are two totally different things.
Well, maybe not necessarily. So, the genesis of this question was in my life-altering American Lit 2 course in the spring of 1997 at St. Francis College. And we were doing Mark Twain's Letters from the Earth. And there's the one where Lucifer is like, talks about how much heaven sucks. Basically, he's like, the music sucks and it's full of boring people.
Yeah.
All of the interesting people, he said, are in hell. And in that class, you know, the man who taught the course began and ended each class with the Our Father. And sitting in the front row was a nun who would then say the Hail Mary. And it was weird because the whole semester, it was like there was a race to get to see who could pray loudest and fastest. It was this very strange thing. And I don't think anybody even remarked on it. But in the middle of this class in Letters of the Earth, you know, there's this premise that's laid out of, you know, all the interesting, cool people are in hell and all the really boring, crappy people are in heaven. And Dr. LaBrie, who, I mean, it was the same class from the 60s that he was teaching. It was the classic yellowing lecture notes, you know, yeah. You know, kind of thing. And he never really liked to vary from the script. And when he did, it was always so remarkable. And he looks up from his, you know, what he was doing. He's like, oh, well, don't you all think that the more interesting, creative people are in hell, the more fun people? And then he turns to the nun and says, not to ruin your devotional, sister, but don't you think that's the case?
That's awesome.
And it just lost it, you know? I was like, oh my God, he did not that. So in that sense, yeah, Lemmy.
Yeah,
Lemmy's reasonable.
To give a better answer,
okay.
I think, and to tie it back into, you know, what brought us here in the first place is, you know, Caravaggio.
Okay.
You know, Baroque era painter who was, you know, he died in a sword fight in a back alley, probably.
Yeah.
We may or may not know where he's buried.
Nice.
And he was a crappy dude. You know, he was a drunk and a gambler and a fighter. He was exiled from more than one country.
Damn.
And, you know, my favorite painter, easily.
Nice.
And, you know, he's another one who kind of recently... he was always technically or visually a favorite of mine, but conceptually recently became one as well. And again, this goes back to just looking back into some stuff that I maybe hadn't studied as well as I should have in the past. And, you know, looking at how he brought, you know, these very lofty, you know, biblical subjects into a context that your average, you know, layperson would relate to and understand. And sometimes it was as simple as just changing the costuming of his subject. So, you know, it's another artist I like to point people to when they're trying to, like, you know, they're struggling with that way to connect.
Yeah.
You know, with the experiencers.
Yeah.
I love that phrase now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely expect to see him down there.
There you go. And then that happy note, I think that's about it. So again, we will have links to your Facebook page. Again, what is that Facebook page again?
It is facebook.com/gmarsh.art.
Gmarsh.art. I should be writing this down, but you'll have to say it again in 2 seconds when I hit pause. And the benefit show is at the Millvale Sculpture Festival.
Right, July 22nd. It's actually at Panza Gallery. Which is in Millvale at 115 Sedgwick Street. You're welcome, Mark.
You're welcome, and we'll have a link to that too.
Yeah.
And also, anybody wants to send donations to help the artists in the space and its tragic fire,
You can send a check to the Millvale Community Development Corporation at 501 Lincoln Avenue, Millvale 15209. Just make it out to the MCDC and put Millvale Studios in the memo line so they know what it's for.
Fantastic. And again, there will be links to all this on the page. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Yeah. Something's going to happen,
something
right?
Something will come up.
I have 51 of these now. You know, it's good. There's going to be a 52nd. I can tell you that. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes, though that now takes forever and is really onerous and whatever. You can follow us for more immediacy on Twitter at gonnadiepodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Later, meets.